It's time to present Scott DuPont to bring you another episode of Finance Your Movie with tips and strategies to help you get your money to tell your story. It's time!
Big, big show today. I am thrilled to have Greg Hale, writer, director, producer, done whole bunch of different, probably 9 or 10 different films. You probably know him best as the producer of the Blair Witch Project. Welcome, Greg.
Hey, thanks, Scott. Thank you.
So I want to jump in because it's such an iconic, I believe it's still in the record books, is the most profitable independent film of all time. I want to jump right into the Blair Witch Project. And I'll let you set the stage. You had done one short film, Vapor Man, with Ben Rock. And then in the late 90s, you and four of the guys from UCF came up with this idea, right?
Yeah. I mean, I had done a lot more than one short film. I think like a lot of filmmakers, I had made, you know, dozens of shorts and music videos and all sorts of stuff. Was, you know, still pursuing being a creator, being a filmmaker, indie filmmaker, while working in the business. I was a prop guy and a set dresser for many, many years. Many trials and tribulations, you know, just trying to get projects off the ground. And then, yeah, in about 96, I was actually in LA working on a TV show, was about to join the union and kind of like give up on my dream of actually being a filmmaker and just like work in the business, you know, get dental insurance and work in the business as a art guy, and saw 12 Monkeys and was reminded of how much I love movies and why I love movies, and left LA and went back to Florida and hooked up with Dan Myrick, who I went to University of Central Florida with. We were just trying to figure out a project. He pitched me this idea that he and Ed had come up with while we were still in film school about these kids that go into the woods to investigate a witch and never come out. And I was so blown away by just like this simple pitch that I'm like, look, I've never produced anything before, but I know you and Dan are writer directors and you guys are going to, you know, write and direct the movie. So if producing is what I need to do, that's what I'll do. And that's how that journey started. And it took us from, you know, to get to the essence of your show, it took us from, you know, from the middle of 96 until financing wise, we probably didn't have our money together until, end of 97, so a year and a half or so. And even that was like, tons of failures leading up to how we actually made the movie, because we shot the movie for $22,000, which was
the production budget,
the initial production budget of what was shot of the kids in the woods, what eventually became the movie, right? We had originally budgeted everything at about $350,000, like shooting it traditionally, you know, with a crew and catering and equipment, a truck full of equipment and all that kind of stuff. Tried to raise money on that, tried to do the, you know, get a bunch of dentists and doctors together and give them a little pitch and get $50,000 from each of them. That was the plan.
That was you and Rob mostly reaching out?
Or
all of you guys?
Yeah, all of us. I mean, we had a little office. We were doing, you know, outreach to basically anybody we knew that thought had any sort of liquidity. We had an amazing pitch video that actually ultimately did help get the movie made. But we would show them this pitch video that really set it up as if it was real, that the kids had really disappeared in the woods. And now us, Hacks and Films, we were going to get access to that footage, and we were looking for money to cut it together. It fooled every investor, freaked every investor out that watched it. And nobody invested.
Wow.
So then I came up with the idea based on having gone through survival school in the Army of running the kids through like this weird, story-based obstacle course, give them the camera, shoot everything on video, or shoot the vast majority of it on video, and just let the actors basically shoot it. And so that's how we came up with, okay, we can make that for $22,000. That version. John Pearson, who had a show called Split Screen at the time, gave us $10,000 in advance for two episodes. That was half of our budget. And then me and Rob scraped together the other 12. So we shot it with 22. Then, you know, there's a long editing process, and I don't want to get to too, because we could talk about Blair Witch forever.
Yeah, and I want to get to Emerald Anvil, in a few minutes as well. Your new project.
But just in terms of like the financing aspect of Blair specifically, you know, at one point the film was going to be like a big giant extended episode of In Search Of, right? It was going to have interviews and all this stuff. So we started shooting that, like, and we would raise a little bit of money, but we'll raise a little bit of money basically meant me working on other stuff on union shows and like making enough money to like
Invest yourself.
invest ourselves. You know, and we were making me and me, Mike, Dan, Ed, Rob, we were running Paxson Films, you know, primarily as the company doing Blair Witch Project, but we were also doing like corporate videos and, you know, anything that would pay, right? Anything to kind of keep the lights on while we were finishing the movie. And very long story short, eventually landed at the version of the film that we submitted to Sundance. And by that time we had probably, you know, sunk probably about, you know, another 20 something. So at this point of our, basically of our own money, we had probably, you know, the movie that was submitted to Sundance was probably around, you know, $40,000, $45,000,
So
including
is
that.
this where Bob Iger comes in to
Well,
help finish the stuff?
and look, this is going to be a typical story, I think, for a lot of people. Nobody wanted to invest until we were in Sundance. We didn't get any, investors until we were in Sundance.
Wow.
And once we got in Sundance, that was enough of a, you know, mark of approval or whatever, that people invested. And that's where we raised the rest of the money, which, you know, is about a hundred something $1,000, and really all that, almost all that went to the stuff that we had to do to go to Sundance. At the time, 1999, unfortunately for us, was the last year that Sundance required you to have a film print. They weren't projecting digital,
A bitch, yeah.
weren't projecting video at all. So that just that cost us $40,000.
Yeah.
Just the video to film transfer cost us $40,000. Then you got to, you know, you got to get to Sundance. And look, we did, we had a good Kevin Fox, one of the other executive producers. Bob Iger was one of the executive producers on the money side. Kevin Fox was executive producer on the, he actually knew what the fuck he was doing side.
Now
So
back up a little bit. Did you guys know Bob and Kevin, or are you just kind of reaching out to people you thought might have some money?
well, look, and I think maybe this is, you know, this is probably a good lesson on the investing front. We were spending every bit of money and every bit of energy that we had to create content, right? To create something that people could sink their teeth into, right? At whatever level we were operating at, that was our goal as a filmmaker. Let's make the most engaging film, version of a film, cut of a film at whatever stage that we could, right? So we were doing rough cuts of the movie and doing little screenings as test screenings to like test how, because it was such an unusual film, right? So we were trying to test how it worked. And we did a screening at the Enzian, and it was just family and friends. And one of them, and honestly, I should try to remember who hooked us up with Kevin. Kevin Fox happened to be in town. Somebody, and I can't remember who, happened to invite him. He came. He saw it, and he came out after the thing and said, "This, you guys have got something." He had shepherded films into Sundance. He knew the festival circuit. None of all of us were, well, Mike Mignola wasn't clueless, but it's such a ecosystem unto itself, the festival circuit. You really have to have somebody who knows what they're doing.
Yeah.
You can't just submit your film and hope.
Good luck, yeah.
You know, you have to be able to like reach out to people and messaging, within the festival circuit to like get momentum within each individual festival that you're submitting to, right? And Kevin knew that, and Kevin knew how to navigate that process. So Kevin really kind of helped get us into Sundance. And then he also had connections in Hollywood, which none of us did. So we were one of Endeavor's first agent, one of Endeavor's first clients when they first started. And we had a real PR person, Jeremy Walker, and a really good attorney. So we went to Sundance, even though we were definitely, shoestring budget, even at that point, even after having raised the money. We went to Sundance with a real team and a real plan, right? We spent all our money on Sundance, right? Not only getting to Sundance, but making really cool posters and coming up with our own little PR campaign. The whole, like, is it real campaign that ultimately, Artisan ended up using when the film came out. That was just a really blown up version of what we did at Sundance. The missing posters for the kids and the whole thing of is it real and the website and all that kind of stuff. We were trying to market to every program, market to every place that we were going into. So for Sundance, we were trying to maximize Sundance. So we spent every penny on Sundance, and it paid off. We
So
went to
you
Sundance.
make it to Sundance. You got it like a midnight or a late night screening. You're
Midnight
all
screen.
there. Tell me what happened after that. It was
Yeah, so
sounds pretty
yeah,
epic.
so yeah, oh, yeah, it was amazing. So it was, we had a midnight screen and we got into the midnight section, which at the time was not a desirable section. It's kind of turned into a section where lots of sales happen. But at the time, that was not the case. So when we got in the midnight section, we were super psyched to get into Sundance, but we were a little bummed that we were in midnight. But ended up being great. We did a midnight screening. After the first screening, eventually Artisan called, said we want to buy the film. It was the, classic, met them at 3 in the morning at a condo in Park City and negotiated to like 6 in the morning. And by 6 in the morning, we had a handshake deal to sell the movie for. This is all very public. So it was 1.1 million was the sale price at Sundance.
Awesome. Awesome. So I want to blow up a few myths real quick. Myth number one, none of you guys ever got a penny after that. You don't have to tell me, but yes or no.
Oh no.
Okay. So you guys got a little bit of money after that, which doesn't always happen, by the way. Normally they're going to tie you up and own everything.
We did bit well. Okay, the key is, remember what I said like 5 minutes ago? We had a really good lawyer.
Bill Whitaker, right?
Bill was our representative here, and for many years was Haxton's like main production attorney. And Bill definitely was integral part of getting Blair made and getting Blair into Sundance and being along for lots of legal stuff. But our distribution side, like our deal lawyer, is a guy named Stuart Rosenthal,
That's right.
who's an LA attorney. And the deal that Stuart negotiated, with help from Endeavor and with help from for me and Rob in the negotiating process, to the point that we had anything to say besides, yeah, that sounds good. We had a very good deal out of Sundance. I'll say
Help
that.
helps to have a good team and great legal counsel.
Yeah, and then look, and it wasn't like we didn't. It's not that we didn't have to fight for the money, because we did. And again, fortunately, we had a really good attorney who was hooked up, and we could navigate that process. And fortunately, really, there was so much money at stake that everybody was motivated to help us, right? Because they help us get a lot of money, then they get a lot of money too, right?
So next myth, you can say yes or no. The famous video camera story that you bought the camera at Best Buy and then later returned it for $399.
True. But we bought two cameras, and I think it was from Circuit City.
Circuit City, that's right.
We bought two, we used one. We used both of them, but primarily we used one. The one was like in good enough shape. We put it back in the box and returned it to Circuit City for, I think it was closer to $500. And camera two that had been used in the movie, we sold to Ben Rock, and then I think we gave Ben some break. Maybe we sold it to Ben for 350. That camera is now in the Museum of Popular Culture in Seattle.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah,
And
yeah.
someone else, not knowing, got the other camera.
Somewhere out there, somebody has an old Panasonic Hi8 camera that was, which was definitely probably not being used anymore. But at one time, they were using a camera that had been used in the Blair Witch Project and did not know it.
Yeah. Did you ever hear the story about Heather Donahue and the Steak and Shake commercial?
I knew that she had done some Steak and Shake commercials, but I don't remember. Like, I know that they, like, after the movie, they, like, that had been a spot that they had not really paid that much attention to, and then it blew up and they used the hell out of it.
Yeah, they re-released it as a national, so she
Yeah.
got a nice bonus on that. Good for
Or
her.
not, because she was non-union.
I think she got some additional money.
Oh, could be. I hope
So
so. I hope so.
yeah. So let me ask you this before we go to Emerald Anvil, about the Blair Witch Project. Do you think this lightning in a bottle could happen again for low budget filmmakers in any genre, not necessarily mockumentary? And what would be your advice for filmmakers in today's climate in the 2020s?
I mean, look, lightning in a bottle is always going to be possible. But I think the nature of lightning in a bottle is that those particular instances will not be repeated. I think that's what makes it lightning in a bottle, right? Like Blair Witch just look, I think we made a really good horror film. I don't consider it a mockumentary. I consider it a horror film that's kind of framed like a documentary. We made a good film. It's a scary film. I think it's an effective film. And then we got in luck's way. We worked our asses off and we got in luck's way. And there was definitely a lot of timing, right? Right place, right time. So we had the right kind of movie, right place, right time. A lot of things happened. The marketing, the beginning of the internet, the is it real? The fact that you could fool people back then, in a way that you would almost be impossible now. All these things contributed to lightning in the bottle. Is that or those exact circumstances possible now? Probably not, especially not the marketing, is it real thing. I think would be almost impossible to pull off in today's with today's internet. Back then, you know, the internet was like a tiny little bitty baby of what it is now, and you could kind of control the flow of information to a certain degree. Now that's impossible, impossible. The biggest corporations in the world can't do that. So you know, how's an indie filmmaker gonna? So, specifically with Blair, will that happen again? Probably not. Not in that particular way, but is lightning in a bottle possible? Absolutely. I mean, that's, you know, there's lots of reasons why people want to be filmmakers or creators of any sort, right? And some of that is just the satisfaction of making something really good, the wanting to put art out in the world that makes a difference somehow, even if that's just scaring the shit out of people. But, you know, I think everybody kind of in the back of their head somewhere thinks about, oh man, having a big giant hit would certainly be cool, right? And so I think that's always possible because that's always the motivator for a lot of people, right? Not any sort of mercenary way, like, oh, it's all about the money, but just in the way of like
The possibility.
yeah, the possibility. Like for me, it was what I wanted to be George Lucas, right? I wanted to make Star Wars, not because I wanted to make a ton of money, but because I wanted to do for people what George Lucas had done for me when I was a kid, which was blow my mind and change my life and like in a really cool way, right? So,
Well, in a way, I mean, it all started with Louise Levinson building the plan. The five of you guys worked your butts off. You built this team, you got Endeavor, whatever. In a way, you did that because, I was in Orlando with you guys. You inspired literally the next generation of filmmakers by what you did. You inspired hundreds of thousands of filmmakers.
yeah, that's cool. Yes, thank
No,
you.
you really did. You really did.
Yeah, no, that's cool. Thank you for saying that. And look, I will forever be grateful about almost everything that happened with Blair Witch. Amazingly positive experience, you know, creatively, economically, and then like you're saying, in this kind of like, you know, we've lucked out and we have carved a little tiny space of film history out for ourselves. And we've carved a little bit of, you know, we'll always be in some kind of influence for some level of filmmaker somewhere, I think. And that's awesome. I try to stay you know, grateful for that, because it's really cool.
Yeah. So I could go on and on and on about the 9 or 10 other films you did, and then you got an executive producer title for Blair Witch in 16, but let's jump forward to a project you seem pretty exciting about, Emerald Anvil. And tell us a little bit about it, and I guess you're doing some fundraising now for that.
Well, the fundraising part for that is done. So Emerald Anvil is a multi-platform fantasy story world centered on this dangerous fairy realm called Hada, right? So not Tinkerbell fairies, more like Game of Thrones fairies. So we have this big story world, and what we're trying to do is tell different parts of different stories in that world, that the stories are all interconnected, but tell these interconnected stories on different platforms. So we're starting with a podcast that actually the first episode, I don't know when this is going to come out, Scott, but right now it's March 20th, and yesterday, March 19th, the first episode of Black Velvet Fairies dropped on basically all podcast platforms.
Awesome.
That tells, so Black Velvet Fairies is a podcast that tells like an earthly backstory that connects to the story of the novel. Right, the novel comes out in May. The novel is called Journey to Hada, and the main story of that's like a YA novel. Main story of that is two kids get teleported to this dangerous fairy world called Hada, and their arrival kicks off all these different competing religious philosophies or prophecies, and starts like this basically a holy war amongst the fairies that the kids are in the middle of. And then between those two things, we have a board game
Oh,
called
wow.
Dwine, which is a deep history of this fairy world, like the politics of this fairy world through a really cool, relatively simple dice-based board game called Glim. And we're kickstarting that, which is kind of dovetails a little bit into your fundraising aspect of this podcast, in that the board game industry now has like shifted. Even companies have shifted to Kickstarter as a way of not really, I mean, you're raising the money to do it, but it's almost like a pre-order,
You're
right? So you're,
gauging interest in who's gonna want to buy the game.
So and it's really, really huge in the board game space. But I know that it also works in the film space and other spaces. But in this case, we were drawn to Kickstarter because it specifically works really well for board games. And then so podcast has started now. The Glim Kickstarter starts April 23rd. The novel drops on May 21st, and then June 2nd we start selling NFTs for a interactive story-based NFT game, which is called Battle for Hada. And this is reverse engineering the story of this of a war that happened before the kids arrived. So the NFT, the people who buy the NFT are actually going to build the map of the world that the kids are teleported to in the novel,
So
right?
they'll be able to participate totally.
It's total participation, and it's for as long as we're making Emerald Anvil stuff, which hopefully is going to be many years, the NFT owners will forever own that piece of the world,
Oh,
and
cool.
we are going to have interactivity with so imagine a game of Risk, you know that game,
Yeah.
right? Where you got 42 territories and you put your little markers on it and you fight, right? This is kind of like Risk, but with 12,000 hexes instead of 42 territories. So we're basically taking the inhabited part of this fairy world, dividing it into 12,000 hexes, and you can buy one of those hexes. And the hexes come with different powers based on where you're buying it. And then you're divided up into kingdoms, and which the fairies, which the Hadean call dominions. And then there's going to be an 8 to 12 week long interactive story session where you're voting through Discord on what you want your dominion to do. And we're going to build this, really, it's 50 years of history in 12 weeks of storytelling, and then produce an exclusive piece of content just for the NFT owners that are telling that history. And that all is like a canon part of the Emerald Anvil story world. And then in the future, if we keep going, keep doing other NFT stuff, other content, books, novels, you know, animated series, whatever, there will always be interactivity that connects back to those original NFTs. So you're really buying, you know, it's almost like, you know, and my gosh, if we're anywhere near as successful as, you know, Game of Thrones, I would be over the moon. But imagine, like, before Game of Thrones was a big giant HBO hit, if you were able to get on some relatively obscure Game of Thrones game and buy Westeros, or not buy Westeros, but like buy Winterfell and own Winterfell for the life of the franchise.
Wow.
You know?
So it's totally interactive and you're participating. How cool.
Yeah, participating in the canon story world. Not just interactivity of, oh, this is an interactive game, but the game itself is connected to the canon story world. You're creating a part of the canon story world.
Well, I hope this thing blows up for you. I want to back up just a quick second. You said the very, very beginning, before you got in all these mediums, that fundraising is over. Was that kind of just to build a little bit of money to kind of map out this whole plan? And were those individual investors?
And to execute everything, right? I mean, so here's our idea. What we're trying to do is, because, you know, Ed and I, you know, have remained partners for the 25 years since Blair Witch. Ed and I are still partners. You know, we do a lot of stuff, you know, in Hollywood, like, you know, pitching and selling things and doing TV shows, or, you know, really like selling pitches and then getting paid to write pilots that don't get made is mostly what happens.
Yeah.
But, you know, we're kind of in that Hollywood world, and you kind of, you know, you realize after a while that either you're gonna do something that everybody expects, but any kind of like big IP, like any kind of like big idea like this, a big giant fantasy world, you know, Ed and I have almost no chance of getting that done in a traditional Hollywood sense, except maybe we go to somebody, we pitch them. They give us a little bit of money, and then they own the idea. And maybe they develop it, maybe they don't, right? So we thought about going that route, and then ultimately we're like, you know what? Let's go back to like OG Blair Witch days and just do this grassroots, right? How can we start making content around this IP?
And keeping it, not giving it away, right?
And maintain creative control, and then maintain ownership, right? So all the platforms that we're doing, podcasts, but it's a narrative podcast, so it's not like two people in a microphone. It's a narrative podcast with actors, and we got great actors, Gretchen Ludd from Lovely Molly and Chris Osborne from Exist are in it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, really good. I really, really suggest people check out the podcast Black Velvet Fairies. And then subscribe and then review it. But so the idea is like a podcast, relatively affordable. Board game, especially when you're kickstarting it, relatively affordable. Novel, relatively affordable. NFT activation, if you do it the right way, and we found a great partner who's sweat equity. I mean, look, this is a lesson for everybody, you know, and probably a lesson that everybody already knows, but the whole idea of sweat equity, right? Of like, selling equity in your project by having people work on it either for free or for some sort of reduced fee.
Reduced wages.
Right. Yeah. You know, so that kind of comes down to, again, always trying to put the best content that you can out there. Right. So basically, Ed and I were like, I've had this idea for like 12 years. Ed and I have like tried all these different iterations of it. About 3 years ago or so, Ed's like, look, let's just put a little bit of our own money into this and treat it like a real project. Treat it like a film. Treat it like something that we're developing to get made instead of just like, oh, what are we going to do with this crazy fairy idea? So that's what we did. So we set aside a little bit of money. We created a big pitch deck, which I've got like a version of here. It's like this really beautiful,
Wow.
big, beautiful pitch deck that lays out the whole idea. And I started sending that around to people that I wanted to partner with. So this was like we created a deck really for other creatives, right? So we got Mark Ordesky and Jane Fleming on board as producers. Mark was one of the executive producers of Lord of the Rings. We had made a couple of films with him. We sent it with them, sent this to them. We're like, look, we need a producing partner. We'd love to work with you guys. And here's the idea. And they came on board because we put good content in front of them, right? We made something,
You
good
took
idea.
action, you had this plan together.
And we executed it well, right? We figured out what do we have to do to execute this idea the best way possible. So that's what we did. And the deck ended up great, right? And so that was our first step, right? That was our first sales tool. In a way, we needed to sell it to Mark and Jane. We needed to get these producers on board who were going to kind of provide structure and logistical guidance and creative guidance and all the things that we've always trusted them for as producing partners. And that's step one, right? And then you use that to like move it to the next level. And you again, using this pitch deck, we got some angel investors, but I had already started putting the team together, right? I'm already starting to like get partners in place so that I can, when I'm talking to these people, and when I say angel investors, this is like, you know, again, Blair Witch, family and friends kind of thing, right?
That's so important what you just said. You're building this team with experience, and you're really serious about it. And then some of the angels might come in later.
Right, exactly. You have to, you know, you have to put, it's all, you know, a risk reward thing in terms of like, you have to assume that initial risk and you have to put that initial,
Bingo, skin in the game,
you have to have skin
which you
in the
guys
game.
did.
And it has to be meaningful, right? And you can't be like, oh, when I get this money, when you give me money, I'll do all this cool stuff. You have to be, look, this goes back to, we got John Pearson, who's the ultimate angel investor in Blair Witch, right? Gave us $10,000 because he liked our pitch video, because our pitch video fooled him. I mean, at the time, John Pearson's probably one of the most sophisticated film watchers on the planet, no joke.
Yeah.
And we fooled him with our little VHS document. He was so blown away that we fooled him. He's like, I'll give you crazy dudes $10,000 in advance for two episodes based on this movie that you haven't even made yet because of the pitch document or because of the pitch video at the time. So again, we had put the work in, we worked our asses off to make that the best thing that we could, and that got us just enough to make the movie, right? And then just enough to get into Sundance. And then once you're into Sundance, okay, now that's a big proving thing where now you can go to investors and say, well, I'm in Sundance, so give me some money. And then that works, right? This was, you know, Emerald Anvil is, you know, the same playbook, right?
It
Me and
sounds amazing. You built a whole ecosystem.
So, you know, so now the hope is we start building an audience the way Blair Witch did. We started out with a very few people liking it and built. Because we
So
have a lot of content, right? We had a website back in the day, which was, you know, unheard of because Ed could actually program websites back then. Our version of that now is okay, having a website obviously doesn't mean anything now, but we have a badass website. But not only a badass website, we have all these other platforms that we can drive people to. And we're creating all this content across social media. We're doing like lots of custom videos for TikTok. We're doing, you know, lots of custom media for the different social platforms to try to emulate this idea of we're creating this world, we're executing it at a really high level, And now we want to invite people into that world and help us, you know, not only support it in terms of financial support, which obviously is great because you got to have money to get stuff done, but especially through Battle for HADA, the NFT activation, to really become a part of this, what we're hoping is a franchise that we're inviting people in to be a part of at the very beginning. And if we get lucky, again, maybe lightning in a bottle, maybe something short of that. I'll take something short of that. But any amount of luck, any amount of success that allows us to keep going, we want to really meaningfully keep involving people in this world as long as we're making stuff in it.
It sounds so cool, and I really got a much better handle on it now that you explained all the different mediums. So for all our audience either watching or listening, where is the landing page or the best website where people can go and start following you and learn more?
Yeah, the simplest way to do it is just to go to emeraldanvil.com. And emeraldanvil.com will get you to all the other platforms. And like I said, we've just started. Like the only thing that's live right now is the podcast. Everything else is like you can go and see the Kickstarter page, right? But it's the coming soon page, right? Because the Kickstarter, the campaign doesn't go live until April 23rd. Same with the book. You can go to Amazon, you can see the cover of the book, you can read the blurb, you can pre-order the Kindle version if you want, but the novel doesn't drop until May. And then with the Battle for HADA with the NFT thing, you can get on there, and right now you can see like the basics of it. But part of what we're doing with the NFT thing, because it is very complex, is rolling out content about the game and how the game works. Because we had to create, we're generating these 3D models of 12,000 pieces of this fairy world
Wow.
that all have little interactive game elements built into them. So we've been figuring that out and then figuring out the interactive storytelling. So as we reveal, you know, more and more of aspects of Battle for HADA, the NFT thing, that part will be growing, right? So we're again trying to put content in front of people and not just marketing to them, like putting meaningful stuff out to them, keep them engaged in the story. So hopefully this is all leading to June 2nd. We've built enough of an audience that we get a good sale of NFTs, and that to in total all the things make us enough money to now turn it into a little cyclic thing where we're making enough money to do the next phase, like another novel and another NFT thing. And a, you know,
And any idea where the first NFT pricing is going to be, or have you not set that yet?
I believe the way it's going to work is what the, and look, I know just enough about the NFT space to be dangerous, which is to say not a lot. So I really lean on the NFT guys, which is a company called OwnerFi, which is great. NFT company. We're going to structure it, and they call it a Dutch auction. So the sale price is not going to be set. The sale price is going to slide depending on how much interest we have.
Okay.
So I think we'll have some sort of minimum price.
And that'll start June 2nd.
June 2nd is when the sale will start, and we'll be selling for a couple of weeks and then minting after a couple of weeks. And then
Awesome.
a couple of weeks after the minting, the interactive storytelling part will happen, which will all be, well, basically your Discord will read your NFT, and we're going to have this basically a Discord universe set up that your NFT becomes like your ticket into.
Awesome. We'll go. We're going to put this in the show notes as well in the flyer, emeraldanvil.com. Greg, thank you so much for being on the show. I want to, two quick notes. I really meant what I said. You literally inspired a whole generation of filmmakers like myself in Central Florida, all around the Southeast for years and years and years. And I've said this on the podcast several times before. I also want to thank you. It was outside that office slash house in downtown Orlando. You were looking for money hard. This was right after you did that audition on a Sunday morning in this really nasty bar with sludge all over the floor. Like, I knew you guys didn't have a lot of money.
Yeah.
And I appreciate the fact that you offered the opportunity for me to invest. Now, hindsight's 20/20, but I've coined a phrase, the Blair Witch effect. And I tell all filmmakers this, you're not trying to like, oh God, I hope that guy really invests, or I hope that girl really invests. You're just trying to share with anybody and everyone. And I love the fact that you shared that with me years ago. It really meant a lot to me.
Oh, cool, man. Thank you so much. Thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah. I have a funny investing story with Blair. You know, I reached out to my mom and my stepdad, and I'm like, hey, I think none of this stuff is terribly secret. We were selling a share of Blair Witch for $2,500. That's how much they were. $2,500 got you 1%. And
wow. Oh my God.
So I reached out to my dad and my stepmom. My dad and my stepmom bought a share, and my mom and my stepdad were like, I mean, we want to help you, but we really want to buy this new lawnmower. So they bought a riding lawnmower, a really nice riding lawnmower, Cub Cadet riding lawnmower. And then after all the craziness happened, my stepdad, who's a fantastic guy, was always like, there's the most fucking expensive lawnmower on the planet.
That's a great story.
Yeah. So,
but at least you shared it with him. So he's riding around that lawnmower, but he couldn't be pissed at you.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. 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 And look, man, and what you said about the sharing and the gifting part, that's a very good point about your mentality as somebody who is making something and wanting somebody to come in and help you make that, whether that's asking somebody for sweat equity or in-kind investment or whatever, or cash investment. You really have to, I think, in your heart of hearts, be coming at it from the sense of, I have this thing that I love and I'm really trying to invite you in to help me do it, as opposed to, you are this target for me that I'm targeting, you know, that I'm targeting for you to. And look, I've been using terms like IP and content and all that shit while we're talking, because I know that that's the language of these things. And at some point, and at some way, that's an easy way to talk about it. But if you don't believe in it artistically, like as a creator, whether you're a producer or a writer or a director, if you don't have that really true creative connection to it and believe in it, then, you know, you're kind of wasting everybody's time.
Yeah.
I think you start with really believing in it yourself, which is not always easy. Like, it's not easy right now in the middle of Emerald Anvil for me to maintain belief, because it's hard. This shit is hard, right? Like, I definitely want to emphasize, you know, it's one thing to like you and I to talk about investing and shit like that and making movies or whatnot, and me to be like, oh, I'm the Blair Witch guy, and wasn't it so easy? It was hard as shit back then. And it's still hard, right? It's a really, really difficult thing to do. And so you have to believe in it, right? You have to believe in
that
yourself.
That passion you still have. I can feel it in your voice.
Yeah. You have to have it. You know, if you don't, I mean, look, some people make movies who don't have it. So it's possible. But I think for an indie filmmaker, low budget, micro budget filmmaking, which is, I think, a lot of your audience, you know, and that's me too, right? We're back to micro budget. I mean, like, we're
smart. You lower the risk.
Emerald Anvil, for all the stuff that we're doing, is micro budget. For what we're doing, we have very, very little money. But we believe in it. We have passion for it. That translated into people investing. Now, hopefully, we can keep translating that over and over again into building an audience, right? It's all an extension of the same thing, right? Starting with you believing in your idea and seeing it through and being a little crazy, right? Ed and I joke all the time, right? You have to be a little delusional, because if you weren't, you would never do this, because it's the odds are so against you, right?
I mean, Elon Musk. So we're all the great people that broke the mold.
Exactly. So, You know, it can't just be, oh, I'm, you know, willy-nilly. That's what I was saying. That's what I think everything that we've been talking about today emphasizes. The stuff that you've been catching on, hanging on, or emphasizing is getting a having a plan and putting a team together and then executing, right? And step by step and trying to get to this place that you want to go, right? That it is a process and it is a shit ton of work, right? And you have to look at the fundraising process and the development process, even though sometimes that's not sexy and that's not fun and that's not what you thought about doing when you got inspired to be a filmmaker. It is part of the process, right? And you have to pay as much attention to that as an indie filmmaker as you do to the other aspects, right? And if you can't do it, like if you're a writer, director guy, and I'm just like, oh, I just want to be the creative, then you better find a producer who will do that,
Or
right?
four other guys. You guys made
Or,
such a great team.
yeah, yes, exactly. We
Yeah.
really, we had Ed and Dan kind of leading everything. Creatively, we had, me, contributing, certain production side producer stuff, Rob Cowie doing a lot of financial side, investor side, producer stuff, and Mike Manello doing like, incredible marketing and awareness of that kind of stuff. Yeah, we really, again, look, put ourselves in luck's way, right? Like Dan and Ed pitched me, got me involved. I pitched Rob, got Rob involved. Mike came in because we were doing something, right? We were,
Yeah.
we weren't just sitting around like, oh, well, what, it wouldn't this be a cool idea? And, and going and networking about it. We did it. We just started doing it,
Yeah.
right? That's probably the biggest key to all this. It's like, you just got to do it. You
Yep.
just got to do it, right?
Well, great.
Whatever you can do, you got to do it.
Yep. Great story. I love all you guys. And thank you so much for your time today. And I wish you all the best on Emerald Anvil.
Scott, thanks a lot for having me on, man. It's good talking to you.
It's time!
There's never been a better time to make your own film. And if you have a dream project you're excited about and 100% committed to getting it funded, go to financeyourmovie.com, click on the green telephone, you'll see our calendar and find an open spot. We'll do a one-on-one call, which will be the best hour you've ever spent getting clarity and strategy towards financing your movie.